say, I really well, my grade of this, you know.
Now we do.
Yeah, that's great. Okay.
So, everyone, if we can get moving. Okay, what I'm going to talk about today is the mystical experience and global workspace theory. Now, this might seem like a very incongruous combination of things, because mystical experience, of course, is a quintessential first-person stuff. And global workspace theory is a very complex cognitive theory with functional boxes and models flowcharts that has been put forth by Bernie Barth as a cognitive theory of access consciousness. So this is completely third person and this is completely first person. And in a sense, this is kind of my model of, at least one model of how first person science can progress, which is that you have the experience, which of course is primary, and from the experience, you create a third person model, and the experience and the third person model feedback on each other, each informing the other. So the third person model helps you somewhat in solving problems related to experience, perhaps. And the first person model, of course, is the data on which the third person, the first person experience is the data on which the third person model is based. So why mystical experience? Because I think that in science, just as Newton would have gotten nowhere if he had tried to analyze the complicated movements of a train, say, with all the friction and other forces, he started with a simple system, which is, an object falling or, the Earth going around the Moon. You take away all, you don't consider all the planets when you try to make a model. So, and also, in the medical field, for example, you look at simple organisms. You don't look at something very complex. Mystical experience, in some ways, is probably a very simple experience. It's a very basic experience. It doesn't have all the categories that our normal experience has. And in that sense, I think it is a kind of lab model of phenomenal experience. It's kind of the E. coli of phenomenal experience. So let's consider what mystical experience looks like. These are some of the characteristics. And when we go through this list, what I want you to do is really try and imagine what that experience would be like. Because it's completely unlike anything that you experience every day. So the first quality is that it has this unitive nature, this feel of oneness. And when mystics talk about it, it's very common. As they say, what did the Zen master say to the hamburger vendor? Make me one with everything.
But you can ask in the context of this case. Have you had mystical experiences?
No. This is what I'm going to describe. It's a full-fledged mystical experience, which maybe five people in history might have had, or maybe 100. But lots of people have small subsets of these, and I've had something that is, nothing as grand as this, but I've had some aspects of it. So that's the first one is the oneness quality. Second is reality. That is, this experience feels more real than the experience of the everyday world. So, and that's why when a mystic comes out of it, he's convinced that he has encountered a different reality, because it just feels real. And in fact, one of the names for in Sufism of the ultimate is Al-Haq, which just means the real. And compared to the idea behind that is that compared to this, the world is an illusion, or the world is somehow pale. So, what happened?
Oh.
Sorry about that. I should turn that off, I guess.
Won't it come through in its end?
Not quite mystical, but
it's inevitable.
I think I'll have to get out of the presentation too.
That happened to me when I was giving a lecture to students. For some reason, I couldn't bring my lecture to the lecture hall on a flash drive, as I usually do. So I logged into the university system as if I was in my office in the lecture theatre, which is fine, and brought up the presentation that I wanted to use. But then after the lecture, I stopped and began to discuss things. And there began to be this sort of funny giggle going around. Because my screensaver, which has got some quite intimate photographs on it, was walking its way
across the screen. Okay, now these characteristics actually were first systematized by a philosopher named Walter Staes in 1960. And have since been, other people have added to them, and these are the main characteristics. So reality is the second one.
Is that space, S-T-A-E-T-H?
Staes, S-T-A-C-E.
Oh, Staes, okay.
And of course he was coming from a theistic perspective. He analyzed experiences in many different religious traditions, in non-theistic mystical traditions, and in fact this was this whole thing was taken by Aldous Huxley as the basis of the perennial philosophy, which was a big movement that Aldous Huxley, Houston Smith, and some other people, Fridtjof Jørgensen, have basically called the common core of all religions. So the third thing is that it's blissful, joy. It's described as utter joy, bliss, a deeply felt positive mood. And in Sanskrit, the term for that is ananda. Then transcendence of time. So now all this is actually being felt by the mystic. And the mystic is actually experiencing eternity. I mean, imagine that if you can. It's, as palpable to them as our experiences, when Russ asks you what was going on in your consciousness, whatever you would say, if you could disturb the trance of the mystic, they would actually say, I'm seeing eternity, or I'm feeling eternity.
Would they say that unless they were within tradition that says that?
Yes, they would. Because there are people who are not in any tradition, who didn't know anything about mysticism, who use the same words. So, and I can give you examples of that. Then, the same thing with space. They experience infinity. Space is, even here, all is one, they experience this oneness, that is, If it's in the outside world, then they see all the whole outside world coming together and becoming one. Or if it's an introspective experience, then if all their experiences kind of come together and become one. So it's kind of physically seeing the union of opposites or union of different categories. And that brings us to the next point, that there's an element of paradoxicality. So there's always an element of paradox in it. It almost seems as though incompatible things somehow become one. Then of course it's ineffable, and that's true of normal qualia as well. But the degree of ineffability of the mystical experience is an order of magnitude above normal ineffability, because they try to describe it with all these terms, and then finally they say, I can't describe it. And in Sanskrit they have this term neti neti, which means not this, not that, or so Somebody will say, is it like this? And they'll say, nepi, it's not that, it's not this. So it's something completely different from normal experience.
So can I just, I'm sorry to stop this, just that if it were, the thought I'm having is that if it were ineffable, then that table wouldn't be there.
Well, that means basically words are very inadequate. In the same way as when you try to describe red to a colorblind person. I mean,
so there's a sense that although you could give those indications, that each of them is really inadequate.
Right.
The traditional image that's used is the finger pointing at the moon.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, you would be making a big mistake if you looked at the finger.
Okay.
But I mean, your analogy is like trying to describe red to a colorblind person. Suggests that, you say, well, that's not completely ineffable at this level, because they have something most people have something in their own experience which you can
point
to ostensibly.
Right.
Now, you're saying that there's nothing in our experience which we can point to, in our normal experience, which we can point to as having the qualities which, even ostensibly, as having the qualities described here.
Right. So in case of red, let us say the other person has an experience of green or even grey, that you can point to that and say that it's somewhat similar but more intense or something like that. But in this case, you cannot point to any one category of experience and say that it is like this. I mean, they give you all these terms, so apparently it's similar to all of these and above it. So there's none of these that completely captures what they feel.
It reminds me in a way of the kind of awe which mathematicians sometimes have when they have come across a paradox which blows the world apart. I mean, when Cantor said, when Russell sent him the problems about the set of all sets which are not members themselves, Cantor said, arithmetic totters. And there was a sense of just wallowing, everything's out of control.
Right.
I wonder whether this is a different class of ineffability. Well, actually, the ineffable is ineffable. Contradictions are contradictions, and this is an interesting example of it, but actually it's something which we have all experienced, even in the common everyday practice of trying to understand the color red.
Right. And actually, the more intellectual of the mystics, like Shankara, for example, in Indian tradition, he was very analytical and basically tried to say why he's saying that it's ineffable. And basically, he said something like, it's not a category, it's not a sensation, it's not a feeling. So, he basically said the same things in a more analytical way, that it has some elements of all of these, but it's more than this.
It seems to be two elements in ineffability. There's the incommunicable, if as a man I try and think of what it's like to give birth, I find there's nothing I can do to imagine it, which is a bit like, it's more, perhaps more extreme version of trying to, a colorblind person trying to understand.
But you can imagine, you can imagine your worst pain, colic or, biliary colic if you had it or something like that. And then you can, in your imagination, you can kind of multiply it, tenfold or something, and you can locate it, and you can at least get some idea.
One perspective on the ineffability issue, I think, is that the best of my experience, and a lot of people that I have talked to have had various kinds of what I call mystical experiences, they are nonverbal. They're silent. They're not describing it to themselves in when it's happening. So, of course, anything that translates it into verbal, into description, doesn't work. It may come close, but it doesn't quite work.
And finally, there's a kind of noetic quality, which means that after you come out of the experience, you are very certain that you've gained some knowledge, even though the experience itself does not have any cognitive content. In the sense, You don't have any images, you don't have concepts, but at the same time, when you come out of it, you you feel that you have gained new knowledge. So that's another kind of paradoxical situation.
Could I ask just one other question about this? Sorry, Paddy, I don't want to interrupt the flow too much, but it seems there's a choice between saying, well, there are, you know, there are mystical experiences, and nothing comes anywhere close to them. So unless you have the full mystical experience, which may be very, very, very rare in history, which I think was something you indicated, then you haven't got it. You've got something which is different. Or else there's another way, another possibility, which is there are actually gradations of mystical experience. So,
well,
and maybe many people have had, quasi or experiences which have some of the mystical quality, which I think a lot of people might say.
Certainly.
I just wondered which of those is the case.
I think it's true in two ways. One is that it's much lower intensity. I mean, you have some idea of what it is, but it's not the full-blown experience. The other aspect is that you might get just parts of it. You might get like an experience of eternity, or you might just get fully expanded space, or you might get just utter joy, which is, beyond what, that comes out for no reason and it's beyond anything that you normally experience. And actually, the experience that I had was something like that. But if you ask people, it's very common that they give you... So people actually, psychologists have made a mystical scale of these 14 elements. And if you take mescaline or psilocybin, the experience you get, in many cases, has, you can administer the scale and you get a high score on the mystical scale.
So that would suggest that there is a kind of something like a continuum.
Right.
Maybe a sort of range of peaks that goes up to the highest one, which is way in the distance, but you can approach it on the foothills, perhaps.
Right.
Does anyone know what you have to take together?
there was an experiment in Johns Hopkins last year, and it was based on a similar one done about 30 years ago by Walter Fahnke. At Hopkins, what they did is they had subjects come in, and they told them that they were going to get one of two substances, and that these substances were used in sacramental ceremonies. And then they were made comfortable and they were given the substance. They were in that room for 3 to 4 hours, and the mystical scale was administered to them. And it was very reliably found that psilocybin gave, statistically significant, mystical experience compared to some other compound that they use as a control.
That's all on the web now too, that experiment.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you asked the question. I was very struck when I was at Tucson, not last time, but the time before, I think, there was somebody who gave a plenary session talk on ayahuasca, which is a popular...
It's Benny Chanel.
Yeah, I think it was Benny Chanel who gave the talk. Anyway, what interested me was that the room was electric. People were so interested and so... And somebody made a little joke and said, well, actually, these plants up here on the stage are...
yeah. But coming back to Steve's question about whether there is something absolutely distinguishes the grand experience from lesser ones, it could do, couldn't it? I mean, I don't think there has to be a continuity. Supposing that somehow or other, this whatever's going on generates access to another dimension of space-time or whatever it is, that is an all-or-nothing thing. It's rather in the old framework or you've entered a new one. And I think we should allow the possibility that there are thresholds which are absolutely, if you're crossing, you're in a different...
Well, this is what I wonder. I think it could go either way. I wonder, there seems to be two very different frameworks of description, one of which says, well, it's either a continuum or maybe a, you know, something like a mountain range with this, you know, really high one in the distance, which very few people actually approach, or one that says, well, it's really like this, you know, and then, you know, there's experience, and then way over there, in a different, you know, there's this mystical experience, and nothing in this plane of experience, you know, has any relation to it.
Can I say something about the Buddhist tradition on this?
Sure.
I don't want to discuss this because I'm not ready to, and I don't think it takes us too far from certainly global workspace theory. But just so you know what the Buddhist take on this is, I think our model is a little too simple-minded, because there are different kinds of mystical experience according to the Buddhist tradition. And you go into certain kinds of meditation, and there are progressions and stages. I don't remember them all, but the last two are called nothingness.
Right.
And then the one above that is called neither perception nor non-perception. And that is called, in technical terms, the highest worldly experience. And it's a mystical experience. There's absolutely no question about it. And it's a quite remarkable thing, I assume, from the descriptions. It's quite remarkable. But then they say, that's the highest worldly experience. It has nothing to do with enlightenment. Enlightenment is a different thing entirely. So I think our model is too simple.
So even, you know, neither of those would have... Nice to see you.
Okay, so to go on, the experience itself is transient. So it lasts for, you know, a few seconds or half an hour, or in case of really, adept mystics like Ramakrishna used to be in these mystical trances for days, and there are reports that, you know, she used to just sit there with his mouth open, and flies used to, you know, go in and out of his mouth, and he had absolutely no, but he wasn't asleep. So it's transient. In most cases, it's just a few seconds. And now here's one way in which different mystical experiences are different from each other, and I think this is similar to what Rust kind of tries to strive to get. He strives to get the raw experience divorced from the interpretation of it. And in case of mystical experiences, it's been incorporated into all the different spiritual and religious traditions. And all of them, you know, there are various different interpretations of what this union that takes place actually signifies. And one point of view, which is called Advaita in Sanskrit, which can be translated as non-dualism or monism. And it's the same Indo-European root, the DV for dual. So it's non-dualism. And in these non-dualistic traditions, the experience is interpreted as I am God. The world or the ultimate, and I unite, and I become that thing. So the Sanskrit formula for that, Aham Brahmasmi or Shivoha, means I am Brahma or I am Shiva. And of course, this statement is heretical in some traditions. They just cannot stomach that. And a few mystics in both Islam and Christianity who actually expressed this in these terms were either ostracized or killed or various things like that. So in faith traditions, which can be broadly in Sanskrit, the classification is bhakti traditions, which is any devotional tradition of any kind where God is seen as the ultimate and you are always seen as somebody below God. What they say is, I lose myself in God, so I unite with God. And there's a third tradition which sees the logic in both of these, and that's called qualified non-dualism, which is Vishishta Advaita, which says, I become one with God, but retain my separateness. So I remain a sinful creature or whatever, but at that moment, I God takes me to him. So this is one aspect of the mystical experience which is variable. The other aspects are common to different traditions. And Finally, what are the long-term effects? There may or may not be a transformation in a person when they have a mystical experience. In most cases, there is. And even in this Hopkins experiment, they actually interviewed the person and his or her co-workers 1 year after they had this drug-induced mystical experience. And objectively, they were able to show that in a statistically significant way, the person had, you know, become a better person, in the sense that the co-workers saw him as more cooperative and so on. The long-term effects generally are that you are more loving and more sensitive. And the other transformation is that you are certain about the deep meaning of that experience. So, you know, that certainty is something that it's kind of groggy. I mean, it's gut level. It's not something that you can give reasons for. Okay, so that's mystical experience, and so we leave the first person experience at that point, and let's go to global workspace theory.
Just on this question of the transformation in terms of your, you know, being more loving and more sensitive, what would happen if you were already hugely loving and sensitive? If you were definitely Aroda, for example, the right Turkish assistant who worked with that family, it would, you know, from what I know of her, it would be extraordinarily difficult to get any more loving and sensitive. So it's interesting, well, I'll tell you why I'm asking this question. Is it that mystical experiences come to people who aren't particularly loving and sensitive, and therefore transformation is terribly noticeable?
No, I wouldn't think so. I think that, you know, it can make you more loving and sensitive than you were. That's it. I mean, no matter where you were.
Even if you were asymptotic. Okay.
Right.
Can you say a bit more about the occurrence of such experiences without a cultural context which allows you to expect?
They occur. Maybe the same frequency or maybe a slightly reduced frequency in those contexts as well. Because, you know, first of all, there are atheistic or non-theistic traditions which have mystical experiences as well. For example, I mean, Plotinus had, you know, all his one is pretty well seen in his writings, and there's no theism at all. Then there were people, you know, just there's a person called R.M. Buck who wrote a book called Global Consciousness. He was just having a poetry session with his friends, and he was very relaxed, and suddenly he had this, you know, life-changing mystical experience, which lasted just a few seconds, but it so changed his life that he devoted his whole life to researching about it, and he wrote this book. He collected all the mystical writings and showed how his experience was, you know, similar to those of the religion. And he was not in any way looking for it or anything like that. So I think that it happens without a cultural context. Of course, in various traditions, you're looking for it, so you've collected a series of techniques to try and get it. But it can happen without that as well.
But I was a question about the other point, where it was like certainty or something, certainty of
right.
Deeper meaning.
Right.
I wonder, after what Nick was saying in his presentation, what, for example, if Nick was induced because he knows that it is actually the trick of evolution to have these ideas about God and immortal soul, whatever. So what would happen? I mean,
yeah, he
knows in one time, and now he would be certain that there is something, or
no, he would be certain of his interpretation of it.
Well, actually, we've got an example, which is A.J. Ayer, who at the end of his life had a near-death experience. And it was transformative for him. I mean, he wrote a piece of article for the Sunday Times saying he had now doubted his atheistic position. So it could change even the partners and skeptics. He went back on it, yes, he did later on. But certainly in the immediate aftermath of the operation.
I can't imagine Freddie sort of maintaining that for too long.
So let's go to global workspace theory. is a theory of conscious access. So it doesn't talk about phenomenology, and that's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to try and introduce phenomenology in Bard's global worst-case theory. But basically, it's a theory of conscious access. And what it says is that you can think of everything, of anything that enters consciousness, I mean that you have access to, conscious access to, as being in a global workspace. So this is the global workspace. And it has these conscious contents. And the to enter the global workspace, the contents have to be coherent and consistent. That is, you cannot have, like for example, the two interpretations of the Necker cube. You can have only any one at one time. Although Russ says that he knows a subject who can have both, but
so
you know, I find that hard to
believe.
It could just be a slow decay rate. Yeah. That doesn't necessarily mean.
What's that?
It could be just at the slow decay rate.
Right, right.
Well, this, well, it turns out to have been this crazy lady who could have two different programs at once and so on. It sounds as if she was cognitively very, very different, actually, mm-hmm. in a very interesting case, but she's dead, unfortunately. So it looks as if she did have kind of multiple. I wouldn't be surprised if she didn't have a corpus callosum.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't have a corpus callosum. She seemed to be able to be
capable okay.
of doing more than one thing at a time.
Okay, and then what happens to these contents is that they are globally broadcast to the rest of your cognitive system. So you can think of this as a theater, and over here in the dark is the audience, and the audience is completely unconscious. So so what is there in the audience? And in the audience you have these specialized processes which you can think of as all the cognitive abilities that you have which are not exercising at the current moment. For example, you might have a process here that's monitoring the feel of your skin, and another process that's monitoring external sounds. Or there's a process here that understands language. There's another process that understands concepts, or you know, tries to make sense of things. So you have all these unconscious processes that are going on here, and everything that's in the global world space is visible to all of these unconscious processes. And when an unconscious process sees something in there that is the kind of material that it acts on, then it'll act on that, and if the result is interesting, then it'll try, you know, it'll kind of lobby to get that result into the global workspace.
So it's sort of like, I don't remember what the kind of poker is, but there's a kind of poker where you put one card in the middle of the table that belongs in every hand. Texas Hold'em, right, very popular now. But sort of like that, right? All the hands are have access to the card in the middle and can use them if that helps.
Right.
Like bingo, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of like bingo.
Right, and the capacity of the global workspace is finite. So basically, it's, you know, you can think of it as one input stream, which is novel. That is, if you're listening to something that you've never heard before and you're paying attention to it, then that's the only thing that the global workspace can hold. If through the other ear somebody puts in a stream, you know, that has different content, then you either pay attention to one or the other. But at the same time, in the ear that you're not paying attention to, it has been shown by psychological experiments that you can use priming effects. That is, you can say something like dog or something, and then you will tend to in your conscious stream you will tend to interpret something which is ambiguous as dog. So So there are unconscious processes that are attending to this stream that you're not paying attention to, but the global word space itself is holding only one stream. And this global word space theory is an excellent framework to explain psychological results of psychological experiments. And Bernie Bars has written a whole book called The Cognitive Theory of Consciousness, where he introduced this theory in 1988. And in this book, he has surveyed hundreds of psychological experiments and showed how to make sense of them using the global workspace model. So let's actually do some of that.
Could you, can I ask just a quick question? It's my own naivety here. What's the decay rate of things within the global workspace?
Well, there's always something in the global workspace.
The decay rate, I can answer it. The decay rate has actually happened. It's very complicated because there's both a workspace which draws on sensory, external and internal sensory input, transient episodic memory, declarative memory, and so forth, but only some of what is being worked on in that workspace actually finds its way into consciousness, which becomes the global workspace, which is kind of a bad term for what he's doing, and it's from there it's broadcast back to all the unconscious medium, rallying resources. But the point is, all these things, sensory inputs, memory, declarative memory, transient memory, procedural memory, they all have their own individual behaviors
within. The reason I was thinking about it in terms of things like the phonological loop, which has a decay rate of so many seconds.
Well, Bars came up with this as a very broad theory of consciousness, and then he got together with Sam Franklin and has started to think through about what it would mean to substantiate this. And within that discussion, they started to realize that there had to be cognitive moments, meaning that what's in the workspace occupies that workspace for a cognitive moment, which is somewhere between 100 and 200 milliseconds.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking of. Thank you.
Right, so yeah, that is the...
But something maybe repetitively within that workspace, within the conscious workspace, so it may actually be that for seconds or minutes or whatever, depending on...
So let us see how the global workspace works for two different kinds of things. One is learning a new skill. Now, over the last few days, we've talked of various examples of this, driving or riding a horse, Susan, typing. And the characteristic, and these are motor skills, it also applies to cognitive skills, like learning a language or learning to recognize a class of phenomena or class of images, for example, like X-rays if you're trained to be a radiologist. And what's common to all of these things is that the initial process where you're learning, it's an extremely conscious process. You're filling the global workspace to capacity. You cannot pay attention to anything else, and you're not very good at it. You work on trial and error, and gradually you get better. And as you get better, you're no longer conscious of it anymore. Your global workspace gets freed, and you can have a conversation or do other things. And how does that work? So let us say that you're learning to drive, and you have five different things that you need to pay attention to. You've got to pay attention to the steering wheel. You've got to pay attention to the road. You've got to make sure nobody's you're not going to bump into anything. You've got your 2 feet, the joke of a teenager who asks her parents for a car, and father says, "What has God given you two feet for?" And she says, "One for the gas pedal and one for the brake." Or one for the accelerator and one for the brake.
She drove in Europe, she would need another foot.
Right. Anyway, so there are five different things, let us say, that you have to pay attention to.
Mirror.
You've got to look in your mirror.
Right, oh yeah, six. So anyway, you don't have anything in your unconscious cognition that can do all of these in a way that's coordinated in, you know, in the right way to drive a car. So what happens? You look at the road. So let's say you're looking at the road, and there's somebody in the path that you got swerved. So the specialized processor that's controlling your hand movements will say, you know, will kind of step in and you know, make you turn the wheel. But there's nothing in the global workspace that relates to the other you know, the other specialized processors, those that control your feet, those that, you know, looking at the mirror, and, you know, other, any of the other six, five things that you've got to do. So you do that, and then you realize, wait a minute, I also had to step on the brake. And so you kind of set that up as something to be learned. You get feedback for everything you do, and what that feedback tells you is that you've got to activate some of the other processors in order to do it in the correct way. And when you keep doing this repetitively, what happens is that these processors form a kind of coalition among themselves, because they've been activated, you know, along with each other so many times that so your hand and your feet and your you know, mirrors and whatever, so they kind of join together and they form a kind of coalition, and as this coalition gets better and better, it no longer needs things over here to be globally broadcast to do its thing. I mean, when the input comes in, this coalition automatically handles all aspects of it, because it has connections. There are connections made between all these specialized processors, and this is kind of a new kind of super processor that you've created in your unconscious. And this is how you get all unconscious skills. And now, when you're driving, you can have you know, use your global workspace to have a conversation. Now, the other aspect.
I mean, that's very different from remote units looking into play, isn't it?
No, it is. In the sense that, let us say that, okay, this is a theater, and, you know, what's happening on the stage is something that interests three of you. And then you kind of get together and say, you know, that this is the way to deal with it. And you kind of reach the proper way to deal with it. And now when the input is coming in, you feel it, and not allow it to go to the global workspace. So that's basically what happens. So in the audience, you know, when the input is coming in, if you know what to do with it, you use it. If you don't, you let it go through to the global workspace. So attention, how do things get into the global workspace? So there are two ways that things can get in the global workspace. One is if you pull. That is, there's some kind of negative pressure created in the global workspace. And an example that all of us have experienced is what's known as the tip of the tongue phenomenon. So you're thinking of something, and you know, you don't quite know what it is. So you say, you think, oh, it was this president of the U.S. He was tall. He was maybe the third or the fourth president. And your, you know, memory over here says, oh, I know what that is. That was Thomas Jefferson. And so that, you know, because that gets activated, it goes into the global workspace, pulled into the global workspace. Now, when you're in this condition where you want to pull things, you want a specific input from your unconscious. And the more you concentrate, the more you can screen out other distractions. So basically what Global Workspace is doing here, it's soliciting only one kind of input. And it tends to ignore distractions. So for example, if you're thinking of something else, if it becomes conscious, for instance, you reject it and say not this, and there's always this negative pressure. You're looking for something from your unconscious. So that's the pull. The other way that things can get into the global workspace is push. And that's basically, I think, what consciousness is evolved for, which is that you have to address novel and important stimuli from the outside. Stimuli that your processors, your unconscious processors here, or even your learned skills, your coalitions of processors, either don't know what to do with, or they know that, it's something that you should pay attention to. So for example, we're all sitting in the room, and now what's going on in your global workspace is that you're listening to me and you're trying to make sense of what I'm saying. But suddenly somebody, if the fire alarm goes off, your auditory processors, which right now are processing all the sounds that are coming from the outside, and they know that those are not important, and they don't let them go into the workspace. Suddenly, this fire alarm is something that's important, and so it kind of escalates the importance of this process, and it kind of knocks on the door here, or it just barges into the global workspace. And the example that a few days ago somebody gave was the conversation with Francisco. John?
Yes. We never live it down, John.
So your global workspace was engaged in a conversation with Francisco, and then suddenly this important thing happened, and that grabbed your attention. That is, it barged its way into your attention. So this is, it seems to me like the function of consciousness, the most important function of consciousness, that first of all, it enables you to concentrate on one thing, but at the same time, things that are going on in the unconscious can grab your attention when they're novel, they're important, when they're unpredictable. Okay, so that's basically how the global workspace works. And now, let's go.
Yeah, by the way, for Bars goes back to William James.
Right.
Idiom motor theory.
Right. A lot of the ideas Bars took from William James.
Quick question before you leave.
Sure.
What about things that push their way in when you don't want the obsessive thoughts I'm trying to concentrate on? There's something in the global workspace, mm-hmm. and that's what I'm doing. I can't stop worrying about something. Where do we put phenomena like that?
Well, I would say that every unconscious process, should be well behaved. That is, it should not escalate the importance of what it's doing, unless it's really important. And if there's a pathology with that, if you're, the process that monitors your, something that you're anxious about, if that escalates its own importance, then it's going to barge in every time.
So it
very just explains why that happens. It doesn't explain
why it happens.
What to do with it. I mean, that's what post-traumatic stress syndrome is. I mean, any association between unconscious elements that gets a very high preponderance of affect is likely to win the competition among other elements which are trying to get into consciousness. And I mean, the theory is really just explaining what may happen
right.
in particular people. For example, you get those associations where there's a tremendous affect associated, and it just beats out everything else in each moment, and therefore continually is occupying consciousness.
So there's this some process in your unconscious that's screaming fire, you know, at regular intervals. Basically, that's what it is.
Can I just make a very brief other observation? This has fascinated me for years about you know, Bernie's theory and also its use in the sort of artificial consciousness area. You know, the fact that people can even think about modelling this in a computer, and it seems that one can imagine they could. Greater and greater degrees of accuracy and complexity and detail modeling successfully suggests that it's not really, although it's clearly to do with consciousness, it's not really a model, a theory of consciousness, because you know, there's no reason to suppose that there's anything it's like to be that computer.
Right, so that's what I'm coming to.
I mean, why did you say that? If it, maybe that there is something it's like to be the computer. I'm not.
Maybe not.
But he says this isn't the model of phenomenal consciousness, but the level of access consciousness.
Right.
I don't think this is a theory at all. I think this is a description of what we've got to explain.
Right.
If you can model it in the computer. John, if you can, as Steve says, you can begin to actually make this work as a way of controlling attention and guiding action in a computer, it's not just a description.
There's an alternative way of looking at that, which is to say that what is modelled isn't functional consciousness, in other words, a kind of consciousness in the computer, which is merely the functional consciousness of us, as opposed to our phenomenal consciousness, but rather that it's modelling the functionality of a being that, were it conscious, would, you know, have that functionality too. But the computer isn't conscious, so it's not even, you know, functionally conscious, because that doesn't make sense without being conscious, really conscious. So the computer isn't conscious, but it's just modelling consciousness. Modelling the functionality.
It's back in the Chinese room.
Well, it is. I agree. I think the way to think about this theory is forget phenomenology for the moment, but just think that if phenomenology is taken out of the picture, this theory very nicely explains how we behave, assuming that, you know, we have access to all the things that we're conscious of. I mean, take the fact that we have a phenomenal experience out of it. But even if you take that out, there are some things that we are aware of because we are, you know, they came into our consciousness. And this theory explains that. It doesn't explain the phenomenology, of course.
I need to be careful if I use the term. I think it does explain the phenomenology up to a point.
But it doesn't explain the field.
The phenomenal aspect. But, for example, this could explain the kind of results which, let's say, Russ gets, because he's talking about, you know, what is in consciousness
right.
at the level of in functional description.
Right.
I mean, and what can guide Steve's words he uses about it.
Right, so this very, very difficulty.
Pratik, just 1 second. I just wanted to suggest that if you could kind of finish your main presentation in about 15 minutes.
Okay.
And then we'll be time for talking.
Sorry.
Okay, so what's the solution to all these problems? And I'm sure all of you have seen that cartoon where, you know, a scientist draws these boxes, you know, step one, step two. And in the middle, he has this cloud, and he says, here a miracle occurs. And the other scientist looks at that and says, I don't quite understand that step. So now I'm going to do that and say, and then a miracle occurs. And so obviously, when something is in the global workspace, there's something else, which I call the phenomenology engine that takes what is there and gives us phenomenology and gives us the field. And you can have your own theory of this. Nick has his theory of the thick moment and, you know, feedback loops, and I have a theory of, you know, which is kind of broken mentalese, and, you know, Stu Hameroff has a theory of quantum tubules, and Roger Penrose has a theory. So anyway, you can take your own pet theory. What is in the global workspace has a phenomenal field, and so we can, as a functional model, we can put content in here, and then we can use our knowledge of our own phenomenology to imagine what those contents will feel like. So what are the contents you can have within the different kinds of contents you can have in the global workspace? You can have percepts, and that is, you know, you're actually looking at a scene, or kind of paid version of that, which is you know, images which are not out there in the world, but which are kind of a pale imitation, a pale shadow of what we normally perceive. Then you can have what Russ calls unsymbolized speech, or
yes.
Yeah, which is basically conceptual, or, you know, what Steven Pinker would call mentalese, which is you know what you mean, and then you've got to find the words, but, you know, you know exactly what you're thinking of, and then you put that in words. So it's unsymbolized speech. You can have sensations. You always have a kind of implicit background, which also came out in those beep experiments, where, you know, while describing each beep, both Claire and Steve started with, you know, I was here, I was doing this. So there was a location in time and space. I was here and I was looking at that. So there's a self and the other. And there's always an implicit goal. So for example, when Steve said that he was, you know, that Wendell was talking, Steve's implicit goal was to try and understand what Wendell was talking about. And also you have affect, which is, you know, the kind of mood that you're in, or the subjective feel, emotional feel that you have. So let's try to...
What are things like beliefs? I mean, are beliefs in the global workspace?
When they're conscious, yes. But
do you think there's a feel to having a belief?
I think it's unsymbolized speech, just like anything else. I mean,
do you think that has a feel?
It doesn't have a very, very prominent phenomenal quality, I don't think, but you know what it is to have a thought. I mean, everybody knows what it is.
Yeah, because somebody said to me, let's say, you asked me, do I know that Paris is the capital of France? I say, yes, I know that. And then you ask me, well, what's it like to know that? I wouldn't be able to answer it. I don't think it's like anything. I think that not everything in consciousness has phenomenal characters or quality to it.
But it does have something, because you know, you said that you know it, right?
There's been some very interesting work by Noe and people on this, on the different, you know, the levels of feel and roundness and so on.
The affective quality with beliefs, that even the belief like that Paris is the capital of France has some kind of flavour.
Isn't the belief actually the deciding factor that decides what will come in or not? One of the deciding factors, not so much.
I know we're not meant to interrupt an awful lot here, but it seems that phenomenology, I know, but it was you said the other word,
did you miss it? I did say that.
I haven't actually done a lot of the banter this morning.
Yes.
It seemed a few minutes ago that what we were talking about in this was a kind of model of working memory, which is what made me think of phenomenological loops and things like that. And if that's true, then the things in working memory have already a phenomenological feel, I think, because they're there, they're present, they're occurring to the agent, they're part of its person at that time. Could be a narrative, the kind of thing that Russ talks about, the kind of thing that Claire talks about, the kind of thing that Jeff talks about in his told stories, but they're part of the lived story underneath that. But we had said before you moved on to this phenomenology engine that in fact this could be simply sensation and it could be simply functional. So
no, I'm saying that that's a description of the function, but we all know that there is phenomenology involved as well. So I'm trying to introduce the phenomenology into this model.
But aren't you already doing that by saying this has affective qualities?
Yeah, I'm just kind of classifying everything that's possible to have in a global workspace. And now we're going to...
That's largely the question of whether just having the affective qualities is enough to get phenomenology.
Well, I think we're still in that
Anyway, I'm going to use all you guys as my phenomenological engine. And I'm just going to put symbols here. So this is, let us say, this is something that you perceive, okay? And this is a concept. And okay. So a square is something that you perceive. Circle is a concept, and a triangle is a sensation.
An intent.
And let's leave that one. I mean, you obviously cannot get the whole zoo of things that you can see. location. So let's have something for time and space. So let us say this is time and this is space. And self versus other. So. This is self, and this is other, and we don't have to worry about anything else. Okay, so basically, what this is saying is that all percepts. I mean, you can distinguish what you perceive from what is unsymbolized speech and what is sensation, and from you know, what your location in time and space is. So each of these things, if you, actually had a machine that gave you your neural states for all of these things, no matter what you're perceiving, all those states will have some pattern, some neural pattern in common. And you can abstract that and call it the tag of perception or the tag of unsymbolized speech or concepts, the tag of sensation. And every percept will have its own content. So let's say you have, and the content here is, Russ is talking.
He's nursing in his absence. He's mentioned.
Well, so let's say you're perceived. So Russ is talking, and you're perceiving it. So the content here is that Russ is talking, and the tag is that it's a perception. And my engine of phenomenology will now take this content, which is in the global workspace, and give me that. That feel of it. So now let us play with this a little bit. What if you were just imagining that Russ was talking? So it's the same, the content is the same, but the modality is different. So what I suggest is, in that case, you would have the same thing. But the tag would be less intense. Because it's been shown that when you see something and when you imagine something, the same areas of the brain are activated, but to a lesser extent. So you have the same tag, but activated to a lesser extent. So the tags can vary in intensity from, let's say, zero to maximal. And so this was imagining that Russ is talking. Suppose this, the intensity of this tag was increased a great, you know, so suppose this was, we make this very thick.
Is it talking too much
then? No, I mean the content is the same. The content is the same. So what would you expect, what would this represent?
You'd be paying more attention to what you're
saying.
No, it would be a more vivid percept. So,
you're paying more attention, so it's more vivid.
You may or, okay, let's say you pay more attention, so it is vivid, or it might be you might be dozing off, and then it would be you know, not so intense. So your phenomenology can vary between something that's dim to something that's really vivid.
May I just make an alternative possibility, raise an alternative possibility, that as Russ's talking becomes more vivid, it occupies more of your attention, or other things that are excluded, and maybe it needs to get larger to occupy more of the space.
Yes.
Of
yeah.
No, if it gets larger, then that means that you're screening out other things, but it still might not be vivid.
Will that?
It's taking up more of the working memory. So it's taking up more of the workspace. If you're paying
more attention.
You're blocking other things out. So I think Steve's suggesting it becomes a larger.
Well, it would make a difference in that it's not a tag. It wouldn't be represented as a tag.
No, the tag only tells you that it's a percept and it's not.
I hope we're going to get to this good experience. I'm totally worried Jackson will cut me off and say that's it.
Okay, let me go ahead. So instead of this square tag, let's say it was a round tag. Then if the content was the same, Russ is talking, that means you have an unsymbolized speech saying that Russ is talking. So it's a different experience, but the content in one way is the same. Okay, so now now I want to invoke what would happen if you were really trying to exclude everything from consciousness. In a situation like this, let us say that there is this pull that's going into consciousness, but you have some kind of metaprocess here that's not preventing anything, that's preventing anything from going into the global workspace. What happens in, you know, this is what's known as a winner-take-all thing, that for contents to go into the global workspace, they have to be, you know, the winner, that's the one that's most intense, goes in. So what's outside, and generally what happens, like, for example, why are redwood trees so tall? It's because they're all the trees are competing for sunlight, and when one tree grows tall, to keep pace, the other tree has to grow taller, and that's like an arms race in evolution. So there's an arms race over here, an escalation, if you will, of all these unconscious processes, and so they will all become more intense till, you know, just to keep pace with each other. So now, okay. So we already done that. Okay. So now imagine what would happen if there is an escalation, but at the same time you're preventing any content from coming in. So instead of any content coming in, all that comes in are these tags which are very highly very highly activated. And so there are three things here: escalation, no content, and collapse, or, you know, the tags fusing into each other. So what do you think happens here?
Grid without the cat, I guess.
Right. you have a sense that you're having a percept, and it's extremely intense, but then it doesn't have any content. You're not seeing anything. At the same time, it feels like it's also a concept. It also feels like a sensation. It also feels like, you know, self and other. So there's no distinguished, you know, normally yourself has some content and the other has some content, but here the two have no content. And same with time and space. So all the things that you need to get your phenomenal experience are there in the global workspace and very highly activated, but having no content at all. Now this experience will feel completely different from normal experience. And you can see that it begins to look something like a mystical experience. Because you have a very intense activation of all modalities, but none of the modalities has any content. There's one thing we did not talk about, which is affect. What gives anything an affective quality? Now you have here several things. You have a kind of implicit goal, so you have unsymbolized speech showing the current situation, and you have kind of an implicit goal here. In case when Steve was listening, for example, to the lecture, the goal was to understand it. So when Claire was looking at Jack folding the thing, again, the goal in her mind was, how am I going to do this? Or how is this done? So under normal circumstances, when these two things, the current situation and the goal, come close to each other, you feel a positive mood. I mean, you feel good. The same thing when self comes, you know, normally the affect looks at the tension between the self and the other. If there's another person there who's coming to attack you, you feel scared. But when self comes close to, like, you know, for example, love, where, you know, self and other are coming close to each other, again, that is going in the affect, in the positive direction. And look at what is happening here. Your goal and the content, I mean, they're both identical because there's no content. Neither of them has any content. So they are identical. So you're at the point where you have the theoretical maximum of your affect. That is, your goal is identical to the current situation. So if the affective machinery is working right, this will be like the height of positive feeling. And same with self and other. And there's a third thing which I won't go into because I don't think I have time. But basically, this state, which is a simpler state than normal, our normal perception, because normal perception is broken into categories. This has no content, it has all the modalities, and it's and therefore it will be very hard to explain this to anybody else, but it's at the same time it's very it has the highest effective quality that you can imagine. So that's basically one possible model of how mystical experience might be generated in the brain. It's actually a kind of more fundamental architectural state of the global workspace.
What was the third thing, just in one sentence?
Okay, and that is what I call cognitive entropy. That is, normally you have categories which are different from each other, and sometimes intuitively you find some connection between categories, and that connection itself gives you joy. For example, when Einstein found the solution to general relativity, he was convinced that it was true by the beauty alone, by the beauty of the theory alone, because the concepts that he was using kind of fit together in a natural way. And I suggest that quality actually is what gives us that aha experience, which is that when your concepts kind of fit into each other in a natural way, you're decreasing the cognitive entropy in your conceptual world. And our affect is actually genetically programmed to treat this as a positive event. There's a very famous passage of Helen Keller Learning Language, mm-hmm. where and this happens in every one of us, but it happens at a time when we are so young that we don't remember it. But in Helen Keller, it happened, you know, because of her handicap. It happened when she was 9 years old, and she was able to describe it in a very vivid way. That there was this teacher of hers who was running water down her hand and making some kind of signal that symbolized water, and all of a sudden she made the connection, and that was a most beautiful experience for her. And what happens when you actually discover that everything has a name? Your cognitive map of the world, your conceptual map of the world, let us say you know 20 things, and each of those have 5 properties. So you have 100 different things floating around in your conceptual world, and suddenly they all get unified by this one thing that you found, that everything has a name. So you have one, instead of having a cluster of 20 different things, you now have a unified clump of just one thing which, you know, connects to each other. And that itself is a feeling of joy and a feeling of certainty. And so this act, the mystical experience, it's like the mother of all creative experiences. Because everything gets melded together in a kind of stupendous act of creativity. And that is why it is, you have this absolute certainty about it. It's you know, you have this aha, it's like a stupendous mother of all aha moment.
I'm sorry, it's a bit imperious for me. What would happen if something with content did creep in? At the moment, all these tags are present. That thing would be invested with all the possible qualities of experience imaginable, centered on that one thing. Is that ever part of Mr.
Jesus?
We combine that with what Augustinian idea of God is the subject of all possible predicates. Right. Something which is the subject of all possible tags.
Right. I call it in Buddhism there's a very it's called the thingness, right? Something like thingness.
You have to say a little more. The Dharmata.
But essentially, you know, this is a unity, and the first, you know, what it's like an it's like a the quintessence of all concepts. You know, it has the phenomenal quality of being a concept, but it holds all the concepts within it.
It's rather back to that analogy I gave in the context of the set of all sets.
The set of all sets, yeah. So, actually, I have, let's go back to first person.
Before you leave that, let me say, wait 1 minute, I really do want to leave time for some discussion about what we're doing next, though. Let's say 5 minutes from now, we end everything, all discussion, all presentation. You decide how to use that term.
let me just go on, and then we can take questions. So paradox, and again, this Escher is great to get some of these ideas across. So these are our concepts as we normally have them. They're all separate from each other, and imagine in this collapse that they kind of meld into something. Into one thing. Obviously there is paradox involved here, because if you look at the beginning and look at the end, here you have things that are different, and here they've all become one. So this is basically what, it's an analogy of what happens during that that collapse and melding of the concepts. And conversely, when you go out of the mystical experience into everyday consciousness, what will happen? And here I'm just going to read that. So if the fused tag state is fundamental and predates normal consciousness during development, or even when you have a mystical experience and you go back to the world, then it is indeed the void that gives rise to our subjective, conceptual and perceptual world. Hence, the mystical God within is indeed the creator of the world, the subjective world, which is the only one that each one of us can ever know. So in this, as in many other matters, you know, the mystics were, in a sense, right after all.
Well, it seems to me that for every Helen Keller example, you could give an example where things come together in a way that is horrifying or frightening. And so, what do you do with that?
For example?
Well, in other words, I all the clues come together and I realize that my boss is trying to kill me or something.
No, but there are two things here. When all the clues come together, you have an aha moment that, yes, you've solved the mystery. But the solution of the mystery is horrifying. So after that, it's followed by the...
So you think there's a peak, some sort of a pleasure followed by the...
Right. You know, it's shown in psychology that anytime you recognize something, you have a positive affect. Because you are creating order out of disorder.
But if you... following that point, if you turn to Joseph Conrad, for example, Past the Darkness, the moment of the moment you describe is a moment of horror, absolute horror. The guy sees, realizes that which the colonialists are doing, and it was.
No, but again,
so it doesn't have to be positive.
No, what I'm saying is that the content is horrible, but the act of coming, you know, of getting a new idea out of two things, that connecting two things, that process itself is pleasurable.
Feminists described the attack on the Twin Towers, 9/11, as the greatest work of art man has ever created.
Well, you know, it is now 10:45.
At 11 o'clock, we'll start with the next session. We'll take a break now. If people want to keep talking, that's fine. But let's make sure we start at 11 o'clock with the next session.
Could be very different. Our name is Horror. Ramakrishna and Kali.
Right.
Because it's all embodied in Kali.
Right. So, actually, I think that you can have that any experience where you only have a tag in there without content
are we going to do
has the elements of the mystery.
So,
I did actually, but it's not been published.
Can we come in?
Sure, I can email it. What Barthes did is he took like hundreds of results in psychology and he just made this model that is consistent with all of them. So it is based on that. But you have both active attention and passive attention and you know, things that right, things that come together.
I had some real sort of knocked out by the form.
It's a framework,
They don't have
a
huge amount of information.
No, Mulligan is an algorithm. You know, it's a data process. And when a certain result is
reached, for example, you said that the branch of the fire alarm. So where is this?
Okay.
Why would they just do it?
Because there are processors here that monitor danger for the panic. So there's auditory processor.
So, but then if it's your event from a gas, then so that there is like a certain number of processors that monitor a certain function. Something else has to be able to do that. We don't even. So, for example, that doesn't mean that we have a certain reality out there. We are not monitoring it. So it is out there, but we don't see it. We don't experience it anyway. You know that normally the theory that we, I mean that our perception that we know, we have access to everything, but it doesn't do that. And that there are, that there might be a huge part of reality that we don't have access to.
Yeah, we're monitoring everything, but how do we have access to
everything?
Everything is, for example, you're sitting on a chair. And your receptors in your legs are coming in contact with the chair.
But
this is something that they're equipped to deal with, so they don't bring it to your conscious attention. But the moment a bug starts crawling, suddenly it's something novel.
So it'd be interesting if it is like that, so we have just simple like controlling sensors. It's like cameras that go around the house. But of course cameras that don't cover everything. They just cover certain areas and they go like So what if we don't have access? I mean, sorry, for this theory, we cannot know. Perhaps there is some reality out there, we have absolutely no access.
But still, if it becomes one of the modalities that we can react to, we will not be one. I didn't really understand what you said. You're saying there are things outside that we.
But actually, the question was probably different. So it was like, how these things know. Then you said, well, that's hardware. It's like hardwired.
Right, hardwired. Or it's learned.
But isn't. I mean, you know, when I was doing this. Consciousness modeling, and always there was a problem. You can really well model in many ways, there are many models, but then at the end you just need some consciousness in there to do everything.
I mean, I leave that to you. You can have your own theory. How the consciousness is
generated. Yeah,
you're
all doing that, actually. Yeah.
Question about your presentation.
Please don't. No, I'm joking.
It's quick.
Yeah. Can we go out? Yes.
I'm
always
going
to
say
results in Berlin on the flood on that family. It's not the same genes.
Oh, great. And you can see the richer quality of language.
So that's the third thing.
Is it just the form of projection of your association with those?
Rather than put them on a screen, which I can't be bothered. This is some photos of last year's.
Green, the color green.
This is something I've heard from several years ago.
You need all those diagrams. It makes much of sense to talk to different people about it. It's very interesting, though. Right? Email from the learner, because, you know, this really is a convergence of love and genocide. He thinks he's having the genes for quadrupeds or quadrupeds.
Or is there some distinction?
That was just making up.
Increases the activation of that subcortical process and makes it conscious. So it pushes its content into the global
workspace.
If you only need consciousness when you have dealt with something unexpected. Except that you wouldn't know, and wouldn't be able to give it the very complex skill of walking without learning it. That's what you need to do.
Maybe
really weird.
fundamentally something more sensory and a
level.
I want to talk
about
dinner.
John's like a song, yeah, that's a self-perception. What is your email? Nick?
M.Humphrey.
Have
we lost people?
I saw Russ and
Doug Humphrey.
Steve Walker.
I think everybody else sees there.
UK.
Spengers.
Without the L.
Spengers.
Spengers.
Okay. The reason I really wanted to make sure that this meeting gets started on time is because I see it as a business meeting. You know, the question is moving ahead, moving forward, what happens now? And so it seems to me there are some agenda items, and I actually even decided that I'm going to run this meeting, we're going to do it with a whiteboard, and we do it. So I have several items on the agenda.
You are.
And maybe some other people would like to add some others. Let me just tell you what's on my agenda. First of all, just to confirm and make sure we're all in agreement on how we're going to work the case, what we're going to do with the proceedings of this conference, how we're going to store those and make them available and so on. The second item on the agenda would be the meeting that's coming up, Tucson in Exile, as Wendell said, the Budapest conference, and what is intended for that. The third item on my agenda would be whether we want to try to organize a conference like this one somewhere in Europe, including the UK, for next year, presumably, or whenever. And then that starts to get into funding issues, but I don't think we can do too much with that right now. The fourth item on the agenda would be whether and if so when we want to meet again here at Rutland Conference. And the fifth item on the agenda is a proposal I would like to make for doing a training program in first-person methodologies here at Rockland Lane, and looking at that possibility. So those are the five items on the agenda. Does anybody have any other items that they'd like to add to that?
Last year we had a bit of an evaluation of the event.
That'd be great, but let's leave it for lunch. I just don't think we'll be. We'll see. We have time.
Yeah,
we'll leave it for us. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So the proceedings here, what people have discussed so far, is that we will make these recordings available, these MP3 files. I don't think the CCI website right now has a link to be able to play something on your player or Windows Media Player, but we can probably make that happen. I don't think it's so complicated. So we will do that. And the agreement was that we will do it in the password protected area for this conference, right? So it will not be generally available. There were a couple of sessions we had where I thought, gee, I could imagine these would be interesting sessions for people who were not part of this. Maybe somebody will have some thoughts about that I mean, frankly, I don't expect there'll be a lot of people listening to this once we post it, but it is a resource, and I think it's good to post it. So the first thing would just be the MP3 files, which will be in the password protected area. I also think it'd be great if people could let us have their PowerPoints or anything else that they want to share. It can also be posted in that area. And I also would appreciate it if people could let us have the photographs that they take. And we could either put those up raw, or I mean, there's everybody's photos, or somebody could go through and select out some.
Also, if you have a paper, send a paper.
Mm-hmm. Sure, PowerPoint or paper.
Mm-hmm.
Could somebody take notes on this, by the way, and just circulate what we deal with now? Okay, but, I guess those kind of documents could be available to the public, right? Well, you know, actually, here's a suggestion. If when you send something to us, indicate whether you would, how you feel about it being available to the public, being in the public area. Okay? Yes or no?
Well, that's just helpful to have someone's paper notes, even if it's not a full paper,
mm-hmm.
even if it's just an outline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So send whatever you like, realizing, you know, it can be on protected area, your alone friend. You don't have to worry about it.
What is the
biggest
more fun?
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask, I don't know about, maybe you just jumped into something bigger than you want. I was going to ask if there was somebody who would be willing to be the clearinghouse for all of this stuff. Because I think I just think it would be hard for Kathleen, she's my natural support, she's our staff, she's CCI staff, but someone who's actually been here, I'm sure she'd do a better job. Would you be willing to do that, or is that too much? You could just do the photo, maybe somebody else could do it.
What I'll do is be able to with Kathleen,
okay.
And we'll
okay.
Maybe
study
that.
Okay,
that's fine.
Because I
won't
have
too much,
coming up
to the
done.
Yeah.
Okay, could the photo show up on PhotoGen, or like that, and easy?
There's an easier way to do it, maybe.
It's sort of instead of
the type around here. Okay. Although I kind of like to have them on the CPI. I like to have the content.
No, it's not like something like kind of on the CPI.
Okay. Is there anything else about what we're going to do with the proceedings of this conference that we want to discuss?
Well, what was. How about an idea that we actually start the initiative for real papers and
for the forum, what it's like,
and then see what to do. If the quality is good mm-hmm. enough, perhaps we publish them somewhere, or
mm-hmm.
we make our own publication.
Oh, okay. So you're not talking about what it's like. You're talking about
what it's like.
But I'm
not sure if it should stay there, or
mm-hmm.
perhaps we go to Toronto Project Studies, which we were mentioning, or something
right.
like that. But that might be a collection point, I don't know.
Okay. So maybe what to say about that is, so this we all understand, is that we would move ahead with the idea of setting up what it's like on the CCI site, and then people would be notified when that happened, and would have the opportunity to contribute or check in or give feedback, whatever it is.
And that will be open, right?
Yes. That part would be open, right?
The left side.
Well,
I think
the left side. That's the theoretical side, right? Is that
yeah.
right? And the other one is by invitation. So, but you and Matei are going to work on that, and we can talk. We're having a meeting after this afternoon to partly talk more about that. Okay. Oh, and then maybe it would be good to mention here. Walt, do you have any thoughts of how you're going to handle this with JCS in terms of doing a report?
I have thoughts, so many thoughts, it's bordering on chaos.
Okay.
Essentially, the question for me is clearly what I can't do is a fair overview of all the content. What I can do is either a fairly distanced journalistic report on what happened, or I can do what I think I would like to do, which would be a more kind of personal
Yeah, how about what it feels like?
Okay, what it's like, right, what it was like.
anyway, somewhere in that range.
I'm going to send Walt some samples of things that have been done in JCS in the past, but I will say that in general, they seem to favor a more personal approach.
Yeah,
definitely a more personal approach. But I think that's what you're doing.
Have they been warned that something's coming?
Yeah, they've accepted it. Yeah. I mean,
oh yes, you said you went out of the wrong business.
Yeah, right, well, right, exactly.
So, okay.
Second topic, Budapest. So there is a conference coming up in July. Can we have a show of hands of who's planning on being in the Budapest conference? 1, 2, 3, not so many. Uh-huh. 3 of us, huh?
Well, I'm thinking of going to the Salzburg one, but I hadn't decided about going on to Budapest.
Is the timing on that such that they would work more or less?
They're designed to work together, actually.
Okay, great. I don't even know about the Salzburg, maybe I'll ask you about that. But, okay, so actually there's not too many people who are going to be there. One of the ideas in the Budapest conference was to work, have a workshop, or at least find the appropriate venue or opportunity for announcing the What It's Like initiative. And if we have other initiatives coming out of this, maybe that would be appropriate too.
Yeah, actually the initiative is more global. It's not just What It's Like, just one thing,
right.
But we would try to make a pre-conference workshop about first-person methods where, again, as many as possible inputs would come in. So that's the idea.
What's the title of this conference in Budapest?
Well, it's the Tour of Science of Consciousness conference. It's the,
I see.
The non-Tucson.
Non-Tucson,
right. Okay, well,
just a quick, if it's a diary exercise, check out the Bergson conference. I know it seems more specialist than you might want, but it's taking shape in quite an interesting way. There may be some very rich connections that can be made, and if people are traveling from the US to Europe, if the Warwick, it's at Warwick, if the Warwick conference is in reasonable temporal shooting distance of Budapest, you might be able to get a post.
Okay. This,
when is it? That's the problem. I think it's early July, but I'm not organizing, but my memory tells me that's roughly when it is.
Maybe you could let us know.
Yes. Why don't I post that? Why don't I send that as part of the...
It says April 7th. Oh, no, I beg your pardon. I do have one. Sorry, John.
Okay.
Of course, you could. If you're on the internet now, you can find out.
Well, if you find out, let us know. We'll question this. Okay, maybe the next two things would be good to look at together. The possibility of having a conference in Europe and the timing of that, and another conference here in Rotterdam. Together, because maybe we decide we don't want to do both, we just want to do one of those two alternatives.
Again, a quick idea. Steve, Susan, and I belong to the Consciousness and Experiential section of the British Psychological Society, and we have a conference in Oxford each year, and I'm again struggling for dates.
The 14th to the 16th of September.
So it's later in the summer, but we're fixed for this year.
With these two gentlemen, Russ and with Nick and Guy Claxton.
Right. But a year from
another fourth person, if you can find Eric Schwitzgeber, who's Russ and Eric have written a book together.
So. For the year, not this year, but next year. That's not the time.
For 2008. No, I think this year is not realistic, so next year is when we'd be thinking of
it. Also hold a non annual, I mean, to hold a special conference, because it's always been
That's a good point.
Down in Devon?
We have the resources to take care of some of the, certainly the administrative burdens of putting something together outside our normal shape. We each year tell ourselves we're going to do it, and we rarely do it.
The thing about having it annually is we do have budget for some travel.
Yes.
So that's,
and the place in Durban is a sort of retreat centre as well, and very beautiful.
Which is that?
The one that Jane Henry talks about, I think. Okay. We've had a look on it. We've had a look, or maybe it's just me who has a look on the internet every time and look at it and salivate.
What's it called?
Oh, I'd have to.
Is it Gaia
House?
No, don't
worry.
Well, if we had such a conference, it's quite likely that the majority of people that would come aren't here, so we should keep them in mind in terms of deciding whether to do it.
But the question is whether the majority of people who are here might come.
Mm. I think that's unlikely.
Yeah, it's actually the majority of people who might come are here.
Well, I'm certainly make every effort. If it's like September of 2008, I could probably do
then that. It would probably
yep.
coincide with the annual conference.
I think that should be. It would be an awful lot to set for choosing a odd time of year. I mean, there are four conferences going on the weekend of the BPS meeting, which I've been invited. It is for Europeans, it's conference time because it's still during the vacation.
So I might agree with that. So you would also run into problems of we'd have to persuade hard. We'd have to get do a bit of hot gossiping with our committee.
That week is that period is a little bit more difficult for Americans who teach.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you're going to Americans who teach, they all pretty much have the obligations to start their courses right about then, so to leave in the first week or two of your course doesn't work too well.
So an early summer.
Or October. People can sometimes get away in October over a long weekend or something like that. So September is a pretty
UK is not too good for that. So even with the supposed global warming.
Well,
Jack, are we talking about a conference or a meeting like that?
We're talking about a meeting like this, I think, isn't that right?
Yes,
it would be
a small specialized meeting in one.
Yeah. And I think it's much more fruitful than setting up again some conference.
Right. It's very specialized, but I wonder if any contact with the Merleau-Ponty circle, which is pretty powerful in the States, might be some sort of synergy could be found there. I mean, people wanting to come and hear what's going on. Who wants to hear about this?
Mm-hmm.
Merleau-Ponty devotees might be.
I have the sense that the time would come if we, if this builds so that we really feel like we're starting something. And I don't know what I mean by starting something. Well, I think we have started something, but that it has legs, as we say in this country. That it can keep going, once it's started, it can keep going. Then I think it would be really appropriate to reach out to other groups. There's phenomenology, a lot of phenomenological groups, Merleau-Ponty, Nicolas Bergson, and others. And to let them know of this and encourage them to participate. I'm just not positive we're ready to do that yet.
Yeah.
Probably after people that go to Tucson would be in that possible candidate circle.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Your feeling is we should have something more substantive to offer first.
Well, I'm not sure if substantive is the word I want, but we should really be grounded. And maybe we are. I mean, I'm open to considering that. But I'm not sure.
It would be a good thing to have some friendly relationships, at least with Franco Bertossa's group, which Claire's going to the next meeting. I mean, I went to a meeting in Bologna with almost exactly the same subject themes as we've been discussing, the same size of group and same emphasis on Buddhism and on meditation and so on.
Yeah.
And they're a very interesting group, but no one else from that group.
So they would have felt comfortable if they actually were here.
There's a Buddhist monk, I think he's called Shimpa, but I can't remember his other name. He's he's who's now the chief translator of the Dalai Lama.
Right.
He was just astonishing. He's, as a scholar, understanding Western philosophy and psychology as well as coming from within the Buddhist tradition. And he was very impressive. And we'd fit right into a place like this.
As it happens, I know both him and John Peacock, who's his vicar on earth in the UK. And I agree with Nick's evaluation of him as a potential colleague, but I think he is certainly open to if he arrives, can the Dalai Lama be far behind?
Yes, exactly. Anyway. He seems to run his boat.
Well, he's a sort of pilot fish.
Yes, Well, there is that whole other universe, Evan Thompson and Alan Wallace, and other people who are showing an interest in this subject, but for various reasons that either are not here. Some of them have been invited, some haven't been invited. And I guess there's this difficult tension between, on one level, this works very well as an intimate gathering here. And it has a certain balance that it needs, I think, to work that way. At the other point, that we think that maybe this is going to be moving more toward a broader collection of different perspectives. And I think there is something to approach those people in a different way and say, well, what would it take to bring these different groups together? What would it be that would interest Alvin Noe or Evan Thompson or Arthur Zion, for example, in joining us?
Right. Yeah, those three have all at various times said yes to coming, and then at the end, all said no. I think you're right. I think there is a tension there, because I've got to say, I feel it for myself. On the one hand, I think this is the kind of group in which we can really get some productive work done and set things in motion and make connections. And then at the same time, I have a feeling that it would be nice to make this approach to the study of consciousness a force in the field, a way of doing things.
I think that's a very clear tension. I wonder whether the best thing is to recognize the tension but not worry too much about it. And maybe, keep small for the time.
This group is about as big as it could possibly be and stay the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
One more person would have been too many problems.
too many.
Okay. So, let's keep that on the table for a moment, the Europe thing, and go to the Latin Wing question. Do we want to aim for having another conference here next year?
For sure.
I just want to say, as you mentioned, is we are just taking this for granted, and it's such a privilege. Mind-blowing, We're just being here in the resort that the people before wanted to charge $2,400 for a cottage, and now we are thinking here and say, well, shall we do it again?
So let's plan for that. And this time of year seems to work. I mean, it works for this group, obviously. I can't guarantee the weather's going to be as nice if we do it just this thing. Everybody who was here last year knows that it rained the whole time.
We assumed that the monks brought it to weatherman. Right. But it was still beautiful.
Yeah.
It was great. Different quality.
Misty.
Yeah, the land is beautiful in the rain, there's no question.
The chirping in the water.
Could
we have a
planned
hike every day?
A planned hike.
Yeah, Jim was suggesting that there were more time, non-structured activity, which would require a lengthening the conference.
Yeah, it would have to be at least a day longer. We made this one a day longer than the last one.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's the thing we can do each time we come every day.
Until we're living.
With
longer periods of unstructured time.
Eight in the morning to 10 in the evening.
That's right.
14 hours.
That's right. We're in the cup.
Yeah, we have to go
home. Okay, well, you know, the details of this obviously will have to wait, but I'm going to assume then that we should go ahead with a plan for a conference here. That being said, do we want to also try to do a conference? Maybe the idea would be that a conference in a place like the UK, in Devon, that you're talking about, would be a kind of a preliminary look into something, you know, a somewhat different model. I don't know what that is, but that, you know, this stays where it is.
Well, I think John and Steve and I'll go back to the committee and talk about it and see what they would.
Yeah, we'll do it by email.
Because Max is involved in that, and Max would probably be very keen to be part.
Yeah.
At least.
Okay.
It's a nice bunch of people, and it's smallish.
Mm-hmm.
There is some advantage in having different people all the time, it seems
mm-hmm.
to me.
Mm-hmm.
And.
Yeah, I think none of us should come back next year.
That would be very self-sacrificing.
I don't know. Excuse me. I don't know exactly how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be determined by who's really available when it's scheduled.
Yes.
I mean, we may enter into a situation where we have 20, you know, 1 year because everybody comes back, and I think we're just going to have to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that juncture, I think it's pretty hard to plan it or say, these people are invited to these times.
Right. Well, it does raise that question about, which we've been touching on, of who gets invited, that you raised yesterday, I think. And we were talking about in lunch, but then you brought it up in the group, too.
Well, one thing is next year, you'll have so much space available, we'll almost be lost in it. We'll be rattling around in it compared to this sort of setting.
You know, next year, those of you who are in the conference center, there's a library in the conference center. The conference center is meant to hold, I think, up to 60 or at least 40 people. But the library is a room kind of as big as these rooms together. You know, the kitchen, this is the meditation room and the living room. It's not even that big. So it's not that much bigger than this, is what I'm saying. And it really is meant more for groups, I'm guessing, of 20 and under.
Once you consider the overall capacity to be...
Once
it's done.
It's 20 cottages, which means 40 people, not counting married couples. So it might be 40 to 50 people.
Okay.
Or other people who want to sleep together. We don't insist on proof of the marriage.
I was once asked, I'll be very, very brief with it, when I was not yet married to Norman, he and I went to Dublin, and we were staying in Rathmines, one of the Trinity Halls, Trinity College, Dublin, halls of residence, and you had to have an interview with the house matron before you actually get in the room, and this just shows you what a mean person I am. We sat down in front of her and she said, "Are you married?" And I said yes, and Norman said no.
But not to him.
you immediately said, What my husband means is not according to your
criteria. I don't know. And then she put it in separate rooms.
Okay. So as far as Europe is concerned, you're going to go back and check on that. And
yeah.
As far as the Italian connection, Claire, is this something you could talk about with them?
Yes.
Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
Nick.
I'm not going to the next meeting though, which is in October.
Just to inform the Azure group of the possible connection.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the point?
Yeah. And they seem to have a lot of funding, is my impression. It comes from Mind and Life Institute. But,
Asia.
The Azure group?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Certainly they've been very lavish in the invitations they've put out and paying for everybody. Obviously, Ratnaling has a certain amount of funds behind them as well, but
right.
Within Europe, it's much rarer.
Right.
So,
that's where I hear too.
I mean, for example, you know, to have a Hilda conference in Britain in some way as beautiful as this would be prohibitively expensive.
Yes.
But for the special circumstances here, it would be prohibitively expensive too. But there are special circumstances. We are able to do it. There's a million opportunities there.
Is it? What's the group? Asia.
ASIA.
Asia. Right. Associates assuming?
Yes, something like that.
Okay.
That was...
Well, maybe the thing to do would say would be to say, you know, we have this, we've been doing this at Rosalind Link. We're looking into the possibility of doing some kind of a conference for maybe the first person methodologies in Europe. And they may say, well, but that's what we're already doing that way. Maybe that's right. But that if we do set something up, would they be interested in some way or could be publicized if you think? Does that seem like the right message?
Yeah, just maybe one or two of them should be invited to the meeting.
Okay. Well, maybe that's the right way to do it, is just invite one or two of them, and if they're interested, they can.
They're
going to work out.
They're going to work out. And if they say yes, then we'll say, well, you host it.
Okay. Let's see. But that's, I think that's reasonably clear now about Europe. So.
Excuse me, Jack.
Yeah.
On item one, briefly, is there a plan or is there any objection to putting people's names, emails, services, keeping sort of a roster of people who have been to these events?
No, I think that would be a good idea. If you write that down, Susan, and work that out with Kathleen. I keep asking her for a CCI mailing list and stuff. She always says, oh, I've got to put it in Excel, and that never happens. So this would be a good reminder. This would be good. Sure, I think we should have a list.
When I tried to do that with another organization, it made it happen. If you asked people to send not something that had to be typed into Excel, but send a tiny Excel file with your contact information in it, then the person at the other end whose job it is to make sure it all appears has only the problem of pasting in your file.
Right.
And it maybe it just cuts her work out.
You can also just copy it, without sending blind copies, just copy it to everybody and we'll get the addresses at the top of the email.
Yeah, that certainly works for email, but I think it would be good to have a list. Actually, Kathleen's very skilled with Excel, so if I can just...
I'd like to have a list to include last year's group, too.
Yeah, and I understand what you're saying, but it should be both years. I think that's good. So we could have which year people attended, whether they're committed to attending next year, but we won't worry about that.
After five, you get a star,
Okay. Well, then, with a little bit of time to spare, I'm glad to see, I wanted to bring up this idea of a training program. This is something that occurred to me a couple of days ago in the shower. Anyway, the idea was I was thinking probably not next year, but perhaps in 2009, that it would be really nice to have a 2-week intensive training program in first-person methodologies here at Rocket Link. And it's a rather unformed idea, but what I imagined was the people who, in fact, are involved in that kind of training already, so I would include Russ and Claire and me, but I think also to provide a kind of theoretical background or structure for it so that people could be investigating how different theories come together. So I'm not, as I say, it's unformed. I certainly don't have a curriculum in mind for this program. I say that in part because certainly one of the fruitful things here is that we get both those perspectives, both those approaches. And the other thing that I'm really not clear about is who is the audience? Is it a general audience? Is it a professional audience, such as psychologists? Is it... graduate students in psychology or whatever else, I think they might be interested. I don't know. But somehow the idea of a training program seems like a really good idea to me. So I wanted to put it
out there. Why decide who the audience is? Why not just put it out there, listing all of those groups and see who shows up?
Would people pay to attend it?
Well, unless we can get it funded. Actually, my thought was no, but CCI can't fund something quite that intensive. Mm-hmm. So we need to get some funding, and that is an issue.
I mean,
Yeah, I'm totally, because I actually have a curriculum, first person
learning. Oh, yeah, that's right, you're working.
Faculty, but it's really not working well. I mean, it's working, you know, students are totally enthusiastic, but I'm not, you know, mm-hmm. because perhaps we should form a sort of group to form a curriculum that I would really interested in that, you know, to see what we can do and what we can offer. Mm-hmm. And then probably it will be really obvious mm-hmm. with what the audience.
One of the surprising things that's cropped up in the last 10, 15 years is the amount of money that big corporations that you wouldn't think would be interested are prepared to spend.
Mm-hmm.
on offering their middle-ranking employees
mm-hmm.
the chance at the age of around, say, 30 to 40, that sort of middle career, mm-hmm. you know, a couple of weeks breather to do something really different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the employees turn up being paid for by people who can afford it, like mm-hmm. Walmart and Tesco's.
Yeah, it's very much about that this generation is much more interested in those kinds of benefits offering the end salary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's becoming more and more a part of the pay package to attract the staff, which they
want. Mm-hmm. Well, we do have a natural group in Silicon Valley. Those things usually depend, in my experience, on having contact with the right people, and I don't exactly. But I do know someone who might be approachable like that.
There are also companies that do nothing but market other people to do this sort of thing.
But do we, really, I mean, apart from getting funding, do we really want these?
I think the answer is yes, because my experience is you can, my limited experience of encountering being president of management centers and things like that is you think you're going to get a load of careerist, narrow-minded people who don't want really to know about you and you don't really want to know about them. No, that was wrong. It turns out you get people who are really seriously thinking about whether they want to stay in their job, why certain things go wrong in their relationships with their colleagues. And it isn't the sort of new agey, touchy feeling thing at all. It's hard nosed. And they want to say, what sort of things do you do that could help me address these issues? And it seems to me that some of the things that you do here happily.
That's been very therapeutic spin on it, isn't it? I thought the idea would be to train people to do consciousness research of a kind which would add to the general understanding of what consciousness is. We're not going to get that from these.
It is somewhat different. Now, what I can say is that CTI, meaning Jack, is you know, would be very happy to do both, but it is a different thing.
Is there a golf course nearby?
Just about 50 miles down the road.
You read Chatsworth, that's only about 40 minutes,
yeah.
Right?
Jack, I mean, could something like a manual or primer of first-person techniques come out of this?
Well, it could possibly be a publication, although you guys are already in the business of publishing your work, you know, and methodologies and so on. And one of the things that intrigued me about this was, you'd have people presenting different approaches, but you know, I think we all have the sense that they're complementary, but what happens when you actually show somebody, work with somebody in all of them? Yeah, there could be publications coming out of this. When I've already got, you know, the name of the press that CTI would one day have, if it had a press, it would be Labyrinth Press. So that part's taken care of.
I think the answer is that who would come in the summer of 2000 and whatever it is, 2 years from now, it's fairly hard to predict because I think the world is changing fairly rapidly this year. And one or more years down the road is might be quite a bit different.
Well, there's, you know, part of, I guess maybe one thing I'm thinking is the funding issues, how do we go about applying for grants to do this? And to whom do we do it? Do we have the resources to do it? CCI?
I think that's a good idea to charge participants.
Charge participants.
For training.
Mm-hmm.
The more you pay, the more you're interested.
Well, that's certainly true. I guess my original thought, I thought of graduate students, and you say, well, somebody has to pay for that.
Well, if you have people who pay you, you just have scholarships.
Yeah, scholarships
included in.
Right. But then you've got to fund the scholarships. But well, we could do it out of the
But they could, be, okay. they could be funded by the other
people. By the other people. I think that's right.
I think just put a tight down on us, I think before we start training people, we both know what we're doing. I'm not entirely convinced that we are in agreement about how to do first person research, or it seems to me that we're slightly running before we can walk.
Well, you don't have agreement, you just have a series of approaches.
Okay, well, then we have to have enough of that and enough people's confidence.
And background, on background of things like neuroscience and philosophy and so on.
I could imagine Sean Gallagher would be interested in coming here and giving some of the background to this, and Susan, well, I'm sure other people here. So, but Claire, what did you say?
No, I wondered if the first thing to do before wouldn't be to have a real, to make the same thing, but just between us, to make a, to have a real experiential session, just all of us. To try to test the different tools and to articulate them, but very, very more experiential than the one we have just
Right.
Maybe it's for the next year.
Yeah, that's how we were talking this morning, and perhaps it might be a good idea just that everybody, I mean, Ross Dunner, right? I think of myself, better than explaining everything would be just to present my investigation as up to this point, and then trust you to help me with it a little bit more. So do the investigation here in real time. And
well, I wonder whether that could actually be a theme for next year. And I don't mean it in a restrictive sense. Like, I would love to, for example, have Nick do a presentation on why third-person approaches more or less are revealing a great deal about first-person methodologies. Whether this tension that some of us do or do not feel between the person, third person is really, is really misplaced enough, for example, or on the other extreme, the methodologies we have. But I think a number of us probably have methodologies that we have not thought to present here for various reasons, because we're presenting whatever was on the top of our platter, at this point. But maybe that wouldn't be a bad thing for next year, that we, if we're going to do a presentation, it's not that we all have to present, but maybe if you have something to say about that subject.
Mm-hmm. You mean methodologies? Or do you mean experience, more experience?
Well, I don't care whether your methodology is something you express conceptually or whether you go experientially. I don't think that's the problem. But looking for what would be the various approaches that we think contribute toward the toward making this quote science.
I would like to say that I think that to have a much more intensive version of what we did on Friday, basically, where you know, I got to wear the beeper and Claire did, and we got to talk about our experiences with maybe more people being both the subjects and more people being the playing Russ's role. Claire's role, outside this.
Right. Yeah, we didn't really have a chance to see Claire conducting an interview, and what I did was kind of a taste.
I think that activity could be extended over much of a weekend.
Mm-hmm. Well, how would people feel about making this one day longer? Is that problem?
It's logical, I think.
The next year's meeting, one day longer.
I don't feel enthusiastic for some reason. This feels about right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that something I've discovered at conferences that you arrive, there's some turbulence of arriving, then you sort of get into it, and there's a feeling of, hey, this is great, and then you want to go. And this has been about right. But maybe another day.
But you are mentally prepared. You know when you will
the go feeling comes one day earlier. So
I would say if it's going to be a day longer, it's a day longer because it's giving people more quiet space or activity space or assimilation space, as opposed to that we would want another day to fill with more intense interaction.
We need space between our thoughts, right?
No, but also, if we really want to do some experimental work here, it takes so much time. That's actually the main thing I learned this year when I was doing this course with students. You know, before I was all just lecturing, but if we want to do something, 2-3 hours is nothing. We saw it with Ross, you know. It was like, just time was going, you know, and he didn't even finish the third beat, you know. So I think we need also more time for if we really want to do some action here for that.
And it's even more tiring than the direct presentation to be involved, and it's tiring, so we have to have time to rest between the sessions, a little more time.
After lunch.
After lunch?
Yeah, after lunch. Maybe the period between lunch and tea would be.
But we had, you know, we had originally planned, I mean, the original schedule was for more time, and it got eaten up because people wanted to make presentations, and they wanted a fair amount of time to do that, so there's a balance there.
And that was what I was going to make an observation, and that is that there is a very strong pressure towards making academic kinds of presentations that we have seen quite carried out here.
Right.
And if we're going to do anything different from that, we have to figure out how to do that and how to structure the situation so that we don't fall into that.
Right.
It would have to be a substantially different structure from what we've done here.
Yeah, in a way, I think people are saying, you know, are coming back to the idea of a training program and saying, well, let's make our next meeting a training program. And maybe we can't do both things at once. I don't know.
Also, I don't accept the implication of what Russ said, that you know, there was something wrong with the way things were done here. And just to take the latest example, Pradeep gave a standard, standard lecture that I thought was absolutely gripping. And I wouldn't, if he'd done it in a different way, I wouldn't have learned so much from what I did.
I didn't mean to put any kind of an valence on it, only to point out that there is a pressure in that direction. We saw it last year, we saw it this year.
Mm-hmm.
There's a natural pressure in that direction, and if that's the direction you want to go, it's fine with me. I wasn't saying it wasn't. Only that if you want to go in a different direction, you have to make a very strong effort, which could be a training program, and that would be fine with me as well.
You may be able to break it up in a particular way. I'm just thinking, let's say that people can do a discernment about whether what they have to present is a more academic style of talk, or what they have to present is more a training program. For example, we could say that the talks are in the morning and the more training sessions are the afternoon, and that you discriminatively decide which of those that you think will be the greatest contribution to the overall scope of this, or vice versa. It doesn't really matter, but I'm just saying that we, just try and structure it in a way that accommodates both of them.
And we could, we could say that the academic presentations are shorter. Because usually people can boil down what they have to say.
We can actually do more by do. We could. I found myself thinking, what sort of a first year or any year practical could I run on these issues? Mm-hmm. I have to know how to run experiments, and I can run practicals year on year. But what could I do about this? And I wouldn't try it out on a student, I would try it out in an arena like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we could then. Spend an hour or 2 hours, but spend an afternoon on somebody comes along with a project they want to try out. We are the participants in the project, and we try to decide what was good, what was bad about it.
Strangely, that would be a sensible way of finding out whether you wanted to have a real training program or not.
Yeah.
the issue is that it's time to stop.
One quick question on your training program. What was the time period you thought of in the shower? For
2 weeks.
When did it happen? 2009.
Good thing you didn't take a bath.
Can we take 1 minute on who should be invited? What is the characteristic? I mean, I have a number of people I might have invited who I think could have been very vital here, actually, but they don't tend to be that necessarily academics or associated with the university. And I thought that sort of that university or academic commitment was part of what had defined this group. Because the question, is that really true? Or is it true for now?
Well, if the Dalai Lama wants to come, that would be great. But I think otherwise that the intention that Nick articulated kind of pushes us in the academic direction.
Well, to find out how to do this research, agree on what sorts of things, how we do it, and what we want to do.
As opposed to, I'm a retiree and I'd love to enlarge my thoughts.
And Nick, you actually distinguish between a therapeutic approach and a research approach.
Well, the word therapeutic triggers what I was just going to say, is that besides that kind of executive community, and I second what you said a while back, John, about the quality of those kind of people. Yeah, I've known a lot of people who've been in that kind of work, and not just a bunch of Walmart slobs, you know. And but the other thing, I was just kind of thinking, there are a lot of people I know who are psychotherapists whose interests are very close to what we're doing. And, you know, that came up quite a bit in conjunction with Russ's work, and I think that's the case with yours as well. And so that would be something to think about, to be a little more open to that world.
Mm-hmm. And the first thing that popped into my mind when you said to me, who or what sort of people? A psychoanalyst. Good one.
What's a good psychoanalyst?
A dead one.
And we have to be careful. Shruti, you think there'd be interest?
You think there'd be interest? Eventually, Shruti will fit that bill.
What about the cognitive behavioral therapist?
Well, I don't know really, because that's more of a very practical method of dealing with, very pragmatic problems. I don't know whether they would see any. Psychoanalysis is much more freewheeling, so I think,
Okay. Psychoanalysis, to bracket by presuppositions, is almost impossible.
Well, let me say again something I said a couple of minutes ago. From my perspective, I'd be happy to work with anybody who's interested in this, and it seems to me there's a number of different groups that are, but I'm not sure that this group would mesh that well with another group that might also be very interested for somewhat different reasons. So
this is kind of in the nature of a think tank, and I think that that's a good direction.
Mm-hmm. What about, this is an example of someone who isn't an academic, but something who's not in Walmart, someone like your children, do people know who it is? And his wife, Jill Parsu, she teaches meditation and through Mongolian Overton chanting.
I couldn't hear what that.
She does Mongolian Overton chanting.
Rupert Sheldrake.
Jill Price is the one. Rupert is just an amazingly original and interesting person. But he's a bit out to lunch. Because are we going to restrict people? If someone holds ideas on the one side, which are clearly wacky, as we
call it.
Some of this stuff on
Rupert Sheldrake,
he's just a wonderful resource. It's so interesting and well read.
Does he dialogue though? I've only heard him kind of being on. And, being on and, imparting the truth to listeners rather than.
Yeah, he was actually in our consciousness program on PBS. It was a dialogue about
he's published a lot of dialogues with him, have been published actually, so he does have a formal dialogue.
Well, I guess I saw it in a bad place.
I don't think we need to restrict as much as we need to be sensitive that people come in the spirit of contributing to a collective dialogue as opposed to dominating it, and that we don't get too large a quadrant of people
with one perspective that will take over the meeting and demand that that perspective be the only thing we address.
I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'd be interested in what's going on, and I think he'
fantastic.
David Pete, who wrote, who worked closely with Bowman, wrote his biography,
mm-hmm.
and is a physicist, and mm-hmm. he's very much involved in a lot of things mm-hmm. you'd be interested in, and runs a center in Tuscany,
mm-hmm.
the Lipari Center for New Learning.
Okay, well, how do we bring this to a close? I mean, this is obviously we're in dialogue about this. We don't know exactly where we're headed. Shall we keep talking over lunch?
I've got a great idea how to bring it to a close.
Hmm?
We could all sit in two bucks.
I think we've all given you our individual appreciations, Jack, and I think we should give you a
thank you.
And to Janet as well, who's just gone out
with
Yeah. The whole rattling staff. I mean, there's a lot that's gone on behind the scenes.
All the rattlinguists.
Hey, Kathy. Yeah, all the right. Yes, that's why I'm here. Okay, well, let's keep talking over lunch, and it seems like we'll keep sharing over emails and things will gradually emerge. And something I usually do, actually, and it doesn't work all that well, but if there are people in particular who would like to think through, who would like to be part of a group that's thinking through this question of the next session or training session, why don't you just put up your hands?
Well,
that's
okay.
Okay.
Do you want to
training program?
Yeah, or and next year. How we exactly do next year? Just sort of how we go forward. We would like. We would definitely like to be involved in that discussion. Okay. So let's put on Susan.
Usual suspects.
Okay. And Wendell. Okay.
Wendell.
We can read all that. Okay. All right. So let's go have lunch. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
I think to you. I'm not sure that I have. Take some spice. You might get some spice.
All right. Okay.
Actually, this is something I had written like 8 years ago. And I sent it to Jason, and that's when I got positive comments from Bernie and.